Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's guest is Dr. Maya Shatrit Klein. She's a pediatric neurologist, which means she treats childhood developmental disorders. And she is also author of a great book. I recommend it very highly for you grandparents out there, you parents out there. It's called The Dirt Cure, Growing Healthy Kids with Food Straight from the Soil. And I assure you, it does not recommend that you feed teaspoons full of dirt to your child. Don't worry about the title. The title is merely metaphorical, right, Dr. Shatrit Klein?
Well, actually not totally metaphorical.
Okay. I'm sorry.
In the sense that actually what we're learning is that microbes in the soil are actually impacting us on a physical and neurological and cognitive level. So there's a certain strain of bacteria called Mycobacterium vaccae, which actually has been looked at when people are exposed to it. It boosts their serotonin levels, similar to antidepressants, so serotonin-boosting antidepressants like Prozac or Zoloft. So very interesting, and other studies have looked at it in cancer research. It seems to improve quality of life and also seems to be helpful in the immune response. And other studies looked at, in animal studies, it was looked at for cognitive benefits, and the mice were exposed to the Mycobacterium vaccae actually navigated complex mazes in half the amount of time.
Wow.
And with less anxiety than the other mice. So there's such fascinating research, and that's just one strain of the many organisms that are found in soil. So one teaspoon of soil contains as many organisms as there are people on the planet. And so we're really, you know, learning only the tip of the iceberg as far as what kind of organisms are there and how they help us. But in the studies that were done on some of these organisms, the researchers have said getting outside, being in nature, gardening, and having these organisms come in through your mouth, through your, nose, through little cuts in your skin, actually influence your immune system and influence your mood and your cognition. So in fact, probably, you know, the way that most people ate traditionally was they got their food, nothing was power washed. I mean, no one had that kind of water power. Mm-hmm. And nothing was coated with wax or washed in chlorine. And again, you know, certainly washing things off, depending on your soil, there can be, you know, problematic things in soil at times, but these, you know, rinsing off food is one thing. There are still traces of these organisms. So maybe we're not intending to go eat big mouthfuls of dirt,
right?
Although I did see that's becoming a thing in Europe, that they're using dirt in food. But it's certainly, you know, kids eat mud pies, they play outside. I mean, if you're giving your kids a snack and they're outside running around, chances are they're getting a little bit of dirt. And on the food, the fresh root vegetables, for instance, you know, there are traces of those microbes. So in a sense, it is about eating dirt, even though, you know, it may not be in mouthfuls.
Is there a health crisis among U.S. kids? You know, we see so much, and I think you're probably seeing this a lot in your office, bipolar disorder, a very uncommon condition diagnosed in kids, popularized recently with the advent of new drugs, childhood depression, autism, of course, attention deficit disorder, which is skyrocketing, autoimmune diseases we're seeing in younger and younger children, childhood lupus and juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. We're seeing a lot of childhood cancer, and we're seeing, of course, an epidemic of diabesity, obese kids who were type 2 diabetics, where this was unprecedented in prior years. And then there's the allergic disorders. There's asthma and chronic allergic rhinitis and eczema. Do you think that there is – what's going on? Is this just – you know, coincidence? We're just noticing this more, or what?
Well, I think I think that a lot of people don't like the idea that there is this growing epidemic, and so they do say, well, you know, maybe we're just better at detecting things. But things like type 1 diabetes, which is increasing at a rate of over 6% per year in children ages 0 to 5, that is not something that you can ignore or be better at detecting, because type 1 diabetes is dramatic, you know, and, you know, cancer.
It's not a subjective diagnosis.
Exactly. So even autism, which I think, you know, this is certainly, this has certainly been the most controversial, you know, increase, where now we're seeing 1 in 45 children. There was a study done at UC Davis, and they actually tried to rule out all confounding factors, including better detection, in the population of children in California with autism. And what they found is that that those confounding factors may explain up to 60% of the increase, but not more. So that there certainly has been a dramatic increase of nearly 50%, even with whatever confounding factors of better detection and so on and so forth. So I think that it's real. I think that, you know, there may be certain conditions we're more sensitive about, but, you know, we know that, for instance, the increase in autism is a very tangible one, because if there weren't an increase now, we'd be seeing a generation of people our age. There'd be a massive number of people, you know, 1 in 45 people, mm-hmm. let's say, who you know, were very significantly impaired to a great degree. So I think
that would be like 3 million Americans. That would be like three. I think that's we'll do the math, and that's what that ends up being.
Right. So I think it's real. I do think it's real, and I think the sooner we face that, the sooner we can start to investigate some of the reasons behind it.
So when it comes to children's health, is it incorrect to view optimal immunity, optimal health for kids is just having like a force field around you, never being sick, always being well, invulnerable to attack by external organisms? Or is it actually part of the natural course of a healthy child to get sick, to have run a fever, to get a tummy ache, to get diarrhea, to get a runny nose and a cough, even some of the conditions that you know, we now want to protect kids against viral disorders. Are we programmed to be ill from time to time?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. You know, we know about the immune system. It's a learning system. And every exposure gives the immune system an opportunity to learn how to manage basically that exposure and learn what to do next time. So the immune system is actually a very social system and an information processing system, which likes to meet and greet many, many, many different things, as we talked about before, in terms of the diversity of organisms that it needs to see. And sometimes it regards one of those things as something to be alarmed by, and you know, releases basically raises the alarm throughout the body that causes something called the cell danger response, and everything kind of goes into a mode of protection, and the cells actually function differently during that time. And you might have fever, you might feel kind of rotten, you know, feel fatigued and need to kind of stay in bed. And we've come to consider this as a bad thing. And we want things to be over very quickly. So for many reasons, I mean, sometimes practical reasons like childcare or needing to get to work. And I mean, that is a valid concern, clearly. But at the same time, our bodies are actually meant to go through a period of convalescence and recovery, so that because the body is what heals itself. It's not something that we can necessarily do easily from the outside. But we've kind of become very dependent on things like antibiotics, which there are times when they're absolutely merited, and there are other times where maybe we're using them too often and not giving the body a chance to bounce back on its own. You know, we rely on things like Tylenol and Advil, even though more and more we're actually learning that things like Tylenol, you know, long-term may lead to issues like asthma, may be associated with an increase in asthma. Ibuprofen may be associated with an increase in heart disease. You know, there are real concerns about, you know, all of these frequently used medications. And actually, the idea of the body being able to get sick and recover on its own means that the body becomes stronger and is more resilient. And so to me, you know, when someone comes to me and says, my child's healthy, they never ever get sick, they never ever have a fever, that actually concerns me, because right. I think that's actually a problem. Not to say I think someone should be sick every other day or every week, but, you know, I think that it kind of parallels with these children who have a lot of chronic illnesses.
Mm-hmm. They have, in other words, an atypical response. It's actually more normal to have a robust response to an external invader, you know, 3 to 5 days, and it's over, rather than some sort of slow, indolent, weak response or non-response.
Exactly. So, you know, I think we may need to rethink, you know, what we consider to be good and what we consider to be bad. But certainly, convalescence and taking time to recover is a critical part of that. So it's tricky because, you know, with this idea, like, when can we make the fever be gone so that my child can get back to school? And sometimes that's a financial issue of childcare or so on. And sometimes it's just, you know, I don't want him to miss school, or, you know, I need to get her out of the house, or, you know, whatever it is. But really, you know, that time of recovery is like, it's sort of insurance, you know, or it's like money in the bank, basically, for the future, to have a nice, robust fever and to recover for a few days. And there are obviously things that we can do to support fevers. It's not like I think we should just, you know, leave children to suffer and not do anything for them. I mean, there are obviously the basic things, which are like, you know, doing cool compresses. I use a little bit, like one or two drops in a cup of ice water of peppermint essential oil, and use a cold compress to put on the forehead, and peppermint oil is very cooling, so that can be very, very soothing. But also things like yarrow and elderflower both have properties that can help with sweating. So sweating basically helps reduce the fever, but without interfering with other elements of the detoxification pathway in the case of Tylenol, or in shutting down some of the other important inflammatory pathways in the case of ibuprofen. So when a fever, I don't even treat a fever before it's around 104.
Mm-hmm.
And the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I quote this in the Dirt Tour, actually says that, you know, fevers under 104 are not necessarily dangerous. Now, fever can be a sign of something dangerous, mm-hmm. and if you have a child who looks very toxic, yeah. you absolutely need to get them
this
checked out.
There's meningitis no or something, or there's strep throat or something.
Yeah, there are reasons that, you know, you want to have your child checked out, and certainly I very strongly believe that if a child is looking really poopy or terrible, you need to have them checked out. And certainly if you have an infant, right, like, you know, mm-hmm. under 2-3 months of age and they have a fever, you're not sitting around saying, oh, this is really good. You want to check and make sure, because there are certain mm-hmm. infections that also newborns can be prone to. But beyond that, if they've been checked out and they, you know, you're told they have a viral infection or that there's nothing serious and just to wait it out, you know, this is when you want to support them using, you know, bone broth is something I like, you know, elderberry syrup is something which is helpful and very safe. It's used as it's a food, basically, but it's also been shown to treat. Actually, it's shown to in culture to kill flu virus. So it's pretty powerful. I use a lot of medicinal mushrooms like maitake, shiitake, reishi, and put those in soups. But and then again, if the fever gets high, things like yarrow or elderflower actually help with the sweating and bring down the fever a little bit so it doesn't get, it might not come to normal. That's okay. It doesn't have to come down to normal, mm-hmm. but it has to come down if it's getting up into the 104 range.
On another matter, there's some new think about how to allergy-proof your child. You know, there's so much asthma, there's so much eczema, so much chronic allergic rhinitis among kids. Some kids have deadly allergies to peanuts or to shellfish. And there's actually some new think in the pediatric community about how to deal with that, how to prime kids for more food tolerance. Are you cluing parents into some strategies on that?
Well, it's interesting because every few weeks or months there's a new study that comes out that contradicts the study before it.
Okay. Right.
As far as, you know, when to introduce foods, which is where the focus is. The focus is, well, should you introduce it when they're very young? Should you wait and introduce it when they're much older? Should you not eat it when you're pregnant? And this is something a lot of parents pay, obviously, a lot of attention to because they don't want their children to develop food allergies. But it seems to vary depending on the study. The one that I find the most compelling is to introduce it during, you know, at least at some point during kind of, you know, once babies are getting solids. Usually that's might be around, you know, somewhere between 6 and 12 months as they're developmentally ready, but to be breastfeeding at the same time, mm-hmm. which makes sense because actually in breast milk there's a prebiotic that babies can't digest, but actually certain kinds of microbes can, and those microbes have an incredibly protective effect on the gut lining. Babies naturally have what we call leaky guts. Their guts are more permeable just by nature. It's normal. But this prebiotic in the breast milk that feeds this particular microbe, actually those microbes protect the gut and make it less leaky. And that's only there when the babies are drinking breast milk. So actually, you know, that is probably the most compelling story I've heard. But beyond that, you know, particularly if you're past that period of time or you can't breastfeed, looking at where food comes from is actually a huge element as well. And one of the things that, you know, people are, I think, not thinking too much about is, you know, they think, well, maybe milk is healthy or eggs are healthy or, you know, whatever, vegetables are healthy, but they're not really thinking about, let's say, what happened to that food before it came to them. So, as an example, you know, we talked earlier about soy and how it's got, you know, traces of Roundup. It's treated quite a lot. We've actually found, and there are several studies that look at children who eat conventional diets, they actually have higher levels of urinary pesticide metabolites in their urine. And when they're put on an organic diet, those metabolites actually decrease. And we know that, you know, for instance, Roundup, glyphosate that's in Roundup, which is its main active ingredient, was first patented as an antibiotic.
Whoa.
So things like that are a real concern, right? Because we're getting definite traces of that in our bodies, and we know that, you know, testing, you know, we know that people are walking around with these traces in their body, and yet it has antibiotic properties. Well, you know, that's going to affect the gut microbiome, and we know that the gut microbiome is a big modulator of the immune system and of allergy. So that's just one example. I mean, even there were some studies in Europe on unboiled milk, or what we call here raw milk. And again, this is something that has to be monitored and tested and make sure that there's no harmful bacteria. And a lot of states actually certify that. You know, they test regularly from different farms and producers. That said, in the studies done in Europe, which in one was over 1,000 mom-baby pairs, over a year's time, they measured that were drinking raw milk, okay? They were drinking unboiled milk. Over that year, they measured their inflammatory markers, and they also looked at how often they were getting sick. And they found that they were actually 30% less likely to have ear infections,
wow.
Less likely to have, you know, coughs and other kinds of infections, as well as having lower markers for inflammation.
Hmm.
So and fewer allergies and hay fever down the road. So
it's not the milk per se or the dairy per se. It may be the provenance of the dairy or the damage inflicted on it by the processing, the loss of lysozymes, the loss of all these ineffable beneficial proteins that become degraded at high temperatures.
Exactly that. And what was so interesting is I thought it was going to have to do more with microbes, and that may be an element because, of course, with food as complex as milk, we would have to do a lot of looking to make sure we really understood the full picture. That said, whey, which is one of the main proteins in milk, seems to be one of the big players in this. And what the researchers found was that the structure of whey was different in the pasteurized versus the unpasteurized milk. And they felt that was likely to be one of the real modulators there. So I thought that was fascinating because we've always been told that, there's no difference between raw milk and pasteurized milk other than that pasteurized milk is safe and raw milk is dangerous. And again, I'm not saying that raw milk is always safe, but I think we need to face the fact that, there are ways that we're contributing to our increase in inflammation and allergy by changing things that our bodies have evolved with over millennia. And, there's data, despite this idea that, maybe humans shouldn't drink milk from other animals, that some people believe. And I think that there's, an element to that that I certainly understand. But, long before there was really even organized agriculture, people did drink milk, camel mm-hmm. milk or llama milk or mm-hmm. yak milk or whatever. That was an incredibly nutrient-dense source of fat and calories and so on. And it was obviously, not pasteurized.
Okay, well, there's a whole lot more about food selection in your book, The Dirt Cure, Growing Healthy Kids with Food Straight from Soil. You can learn about artificial colors, flavorings, dyes, and preservatives. You can discover why organic is better. There's also tips for egg, fish, and meat selection, and even some suggestions on healthy sweets. No, that's not an oxymoron in the book. And it's quite well-researched, and I really sincerely hope that this book finds its way into the hands of many parents and grandparents and that it has a profound influence on our pattern of child rearing and on the practice of pediatrics in this country, because you really have struck gold with this concept. So, Dr. Street Klein, we usually issue a call to action towards the end of our podcast. What are some of the resources that parents might be interested in accessing? Do you have a website?
I do. It's dirtcure.com, so hopefully easy to remember.
Great.
And on there is the beginning of the Terrain Institute, which is this training program I'm developing, which is helping people, both physicians and healthcare practitioners, as well as educators and other people, to learn about some of these modalities, which can include anything from what we're eating and how it's grown and how to be a good custodian of soil to using botanicals for common illnesses. And also something we didn't touch on, which is getting children outdoors in nature and mm-hmm. actually the incredible benefits of that, and how it even can improve mood, cognition, creativity, better performance on tests, and even more to just make them happier.
Mm-hmm. And so, maybe prevent them from requiring eyeglasses, because there's actually some evidence that a lot of short vision, interior vision, tends to just create a developmental barrier to the focusing apparatus of the eye, and that just, looking at horizons is something that a lot of kids miss out on.
Well, interestingly, it's not just that. It's actually thought to be also related to exposure to sunshine. Mm-hmm. So children who spend more time outside, and it doesn't have to necessarily be in places where they're looking at horizons, but actually just being exposed to light, natural light, and being out in nature, it has been shown to decrease another epidemic, which is an epidemic of nearsightedness.
Yep.
that actually is thought to be related to this as well.
Indeed. And in addition, and finally, you have a practice, and your practice focuses on childhood developmental issues, not general pediatrics, am I correct?
It is pediatric neurology, so I see mostly children, although I do see some adults, but I see children who have seizures, I see children who have ADHD, autism, tics, Tourette's, PANDAS, that whole group, and a lot of children who have undiagnosable, you know, who have been to lots and lots and lots of different places and nobody knows how to help them or what to do. So so that's the, and I see a lot of just chronic pediatric issues. I just don't see a lot of, you know, I don't do general pediatrics as in I don't see acute pediatric issues.
Okay. And that practice is located where?
It's in New York City.
In New York City. Okay. All the information is available at your website, dirtcure.com, correct?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And once again, I wish you great success with the book. It's just out and available. I recommend it highly. And I hope it makes a big impact. Thanks a lot for joining us, Dr. Maya Shakrit Klein. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.